I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 87 of Season 6 of Move Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic It's a Wonderful Life, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Emily Graziano of the Flapperdame Film Blog. Welcome back to the show, Emily.
Thank you for having me. It's so wonderful to be here talking about this wonderful movie.
Yes, it definitely is. You know, I forgot to ask you yesterday, what's your background with this movie?
Well, my parents love it. Both of my parents love it. And it's just kind of that thing where, you know, you watch it together as a family. I'm sorry to say that I did not get to watch it this Christmas season, but I'll probably watch it just whenever, because I think it's one of those movies that just isn't limited to the Christmas season. So,
no, of course not. That goes without saying.
Most definitely. But yeah, I didn't watch a majority of my favorites this year, just because I don't know. I feel like this Christmas season went by very quickly.
The time goes by quickly, you know. Yeah. That's why you have to slow it down. That's why you have to slow it down and you know, do things minute by minute.
So. Good point.
You know, come on, you sit and watch the movie. It takes you 2 hours and 10 minutes to watch it. But if you discuss it over the period of, you know, 132 episodes, you get much more information about everything. And it goes by slower. You know,
yeah, it's interesting.
It's obviously more interesting this way, in my opinion, at least. Minute 87 begins with Tommy playing with tinsel and ends with George starting to get concerned about Zuzu.
Yes.
So yesterday we ended things with George, you know, coming in the house, I guess carrying his load with him, but without telling anybody about what's going on. And by the end of the minute, Mary finally realizes that something is definitely, something is wrong here. You know, something's wrong in Bedford Falls. And so this minute starts with, George just sitting there with Tommy on his lap. And Tommy starts playing with tinsel and, you know, starts putting it on George's head, you know, stuff like that. Do you know what tinsel actually is?
No, actually, because we don't ever put it on our Christmas tree.
Okay. I don't celebrate Christmas, so. You know, I wouldn't even know, but we don't use tinsel either for that. But I've seen it in a lot of movies. Tinsel is basically they're long, narrow strips that are attached to thread, and it's actually called lamita. And they look like, and it's like sparkling material that has the effect of ice. So I mean, that's basically the main reason that it's used as a Christmas decoration, because it you know, makes it look as if people are dealing with something, you know, in the winter season, you know, with ice and snow and things like that. Do you know when modern tinsel was invented? Any clue?
Was it around the Victorian era?
It was actually even earlier than that. It was invented in Nuremberg, Germany, in 1610, and they actually used to make it of shredded silver.
Oh, okay. The German part doesn't surprise me at all, because they're the ones that really started the whole Christmas tree with, and if you think mm-hmm. about the Christmas carol, Oh Tannenbaum. So I took German for 3 years in high school, so I'm surprised I did not learn that.
they didn't do Christmas songs in German.
Well,
Or you're talking about the tinsel. Wait, you're talking about they didn't teach you about the tinsel, or they didn't teach you about O Tannenbaum?
Oh no, we learned the song, but we didn't. They didn't like tell us. You know, kids, tinsel came from Germany and Nuremberg, but we were more focused on getting the translation down, I guess.
Right. Okay. Yeah, the question is whether you think that your teacher actually even knew this fact.
Yes.
Probably not.
Probably not.
It's probably not something that people know offhand. But that's fine. That's why they come here, to listen and hear about these interesting new facts about tinsel that people didn't know.
Yes.
Yeah. Playing with the tinsel and putting it on George's head, which is obviously sparkling. Mary looks once again at George, and you can see that she's getting very concerned about what's going on with George. And then George just like takes off the tinsel from his head and starts screaming, "Must she keep playing that?" She's getting too annoyed with the Hark the Angels,
Yes.
continuing to play over and over in his head.
On a loop, constant loop.
Yes. Yeah. Now, I mean, do you know the idea of like annoying songs, that get stuck in your head and stuff like that? So it's
Yeah.
the whole idea that of songs that annoy people. Like I did a search on the internet, and it's a very subjective thing because it's just people writing their songs that they hate, as opposed to trying to give some sort of scientific background as to why people hate certain songs or whatever it is. But what I was able to come up with is the fact that in general, the songs that most people find annoying are ones that have repetitive lyrics or melodies. Some of them that are overly simple or repetitive rhythms. And sometimes if they have excessive use of auto-tune or other vocal effects, those are the type of things that usually annoy people with songs. But again, it goes back to the fact of being very subjective. George is annoyed by this song, not necessarily because of how Janie is playing it, but more because he's just, he's trying to figure out how he's going to get himself out of this situation. That seems like a completely no-win situation. I like the fact that they show us that George is a very intelligent character throughout the movie. He is constantly trying to figure out new ways. I mean, he's not smart enough to get out of Bedford Falls, but with everything else that he does, he still does it the best way possible because he thinks things through, which is great to see the way this character is portrayed here. And Janie then gives a response and says, "Well, I have to practice it for the party tonight, Daddy." And then Pete just throws out and says, "Mama said we could stay up till midnight and sing Christmas carols. Can you sing, Daddy?" And we see that George is already annoyed. I think that when they wrote this, they decided, what can we do to make it even more annoying? He's got the music playing. It's annoying to him, but now let's have the kids whine to him and talk about the fact that, oh, we get to stay up late and things like that.
There's gonna be a party later.
That's right. Which he doesn't even remember that there's going to be a party. Correct. So they mentioned Christmas carols. So how far back do you think the idea of Christmas carols or hymns goes?
Probably medieval times.
It goes all the way back to the 4th century of Rome,
Oh,
where
wow.
they had Latin hymns for Christmas. I'm not even going to try and pronounce the different hymns that are listed here. I mean, it continued for it continued for many years after that, obviously. The most of the carols that people know now started becoming more popular, like modern, I guess you'd say modern carols, but started becoming more popular in the late 15th century. And there were Latin forms of a lot of the carols, but then as people moved from country to country, so they would have different local translations of them. It goes back to what you're saying about with Tannenbaum, for German speaking people, and then you'd have the English versions of it and the French version and a whole bunch of different whatever country you're in, that's where the various translations of the songs would go and things like that. In the 19th century, they published a song of Christmas music books that, I mean, the four carols that are mentioned here, maybe you recognize some of them, is God Rest You Merry Gentlemen, the first Noel, I saw three ships, and Hark, the Herald Angels Sing, which is, what we're talking about now. Are you familiar with any of those?
Oh, yep. All of those sung in churches and like more so old school Christmas time specials. So yeah.
Okay. All right. I might have heard some of them, but just don't recognize by the names or anything like that. In 1928, the Oxford University Press put out an Oxford Book of Carols, which would even have the musical notes in them and stuff like that, not just the words. It has the song and lyrics, so the whole thing. Yeah. I found a list of a whole bunch of all the different carols that are sung in different countries and stuff like that. But I think we'll skip over that. I don't think we
Yeah,
need to
we'd be
go
here
into the
like,
specifics of each of them.
yes, we'd be here for a very long time discussing all the translations.
Exactly. And Mary then tries to rush George along and says, "You better hurry and shave. The families will be here soon." And then George gives her a look. He goes, "Families? I don't want the families over here." But what's really funny is what does he mean by the families? Because, or what does she mean by the families? Okay, so Mrs. Hatch is going to come over, but who
Yeah.
else is going to come over? Harry and Ma Bailey are in Washington.
Yeah.
Are they referring to Uncle Billy? I mean, like the families. Maybe they're talking about Cousin Tilly and Cousin Eustace. It's never quite clear because we don't know, who's supposed to come for this family party. We don't know if Marty's around. Maybe Ruth is supposed to come with whatever kids she and Harry have. I don't know. But then again, I would think that Ruth, you know what? That would actually make more sense that Ruth would be in Washington also, not just Ma Bailey. See, that's something I never thought about. Is Harry still married to Ruth? She's never back in the movie. We don't even, we never even know if that marriage worked out for them or not. What do you think about that,
I
Emily?
don't. Well, Harry went to war, so war marriages, they either end up one of two ways where they really work out and everyone lives happily ever after that, or it doesn't work out because the man that got married is now a completely different human being, and understandably so, and neither of them want to try to work it out, and it ends. So, given the fact that Harry is a war hero and went to war and was changed by all that, despite the fact that he lived, it'd be interesting to find out, like, oh, are they gonna make it, or did they break up? Or oh, that would be really
Well, let's put it this way. They've been married for 13 years at this point, when,
yeah.
at this point in the movie, because they got married in 1932. So this is 1945, so they've been married for 13 years. So, I mean, it's not your typical, the type of, war marriage that usually we see about in movies, where two people meet each other right before one of them is shipped, right before presumably the man is shipped off to war, and they get married, and then, how does that marriage survive later, that type of thing. The idea that I'm trying to bring here is that we've never seen Ruth since the night that she showed up in Bedford Falls. She's we don't see her and Harry. They're not at George's wedding, George and Mary's wedding. And at the end of the movie, Harry shows up, but we never see Ruth. And we never see any of their kids. So I talked about, I think it was yesterday, presumably they have kids, but maybe their marriage just didn't work out. Wow, that's like crazy to think about. So yeah, whoever the families are, they're the ones that are gonna be coming over. And Mary, wants to talk to George, so she pulls him in and says, "Come on out into the kitchen with me while I finish dinner." She decided, okay, let's go to a different place, and maybe the kids won't be bothering you as much, and we'll have some a few moments for you to discuss what's going on and stuff like that. And then little Tommy runs up behind George and goes, "Excuse me, excuse me." And Mary continues to talk to him and says, "Did you have a hectic day?" And he goes, "Oh yeah, another big red letter day for the Baileys." Now, do you know what a red letter day is?
Doesn't it refer to like red ink versus black ink in the fact of like finances? That's what I've always thought it to be. I could be totally wrong, but is that what it refers to?
No, I mean, no, you do have finances in the red and in the black, but here they're talking about the term red letter day. Red letter day is any day of special significance or opportunity.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's something that people would have written in red on a calendar, you know, showing that this is an important day that you need to deal with. So they would write it in red ink.
Okay.
You know, it's the way that calendars have, you know, like special dates, festivals, holidays, you know, that are in a different color, usually red as opposed to black, to show that they are, you know, there's something significant about those days.
That's interesting.
There are countries where public holidays are known as red letter days, or they're known as red days, excuse me. So you have Norway, Sweden, Hong Kong, South Korea, Indonesia, and there are certain Latin American countries that anytime there's a public holiday, they refer to it as a red day because on the calendars, it's written in red.
Okay, that's interesting because I just got myself a planner for this year and like it's all written in black. So I'm
Even the holidays, you don't like
yes.
have the interesting. Okay.
Yes. It's the most peculiar thing. Like I've never I don't think yeah, it's all written
Well, one of the things that they say here is that, you know, days like Christmas and Easter, that they're not considered red letter days because they're not legal days. You know, they're more religious days.
Yeah, everything.
So.
I'm just double checking it now. Yeah, oh, they're all written in black, like Christmas, Easter, like Martin Luther King Jr. Day, written in black.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
That is very interesting. So yeah, so what he's basically saying is that this is another day that you can mark down that something important has happened to the Baileys. That
Okay.
important thing being, you know, that they've lost $8,000 and are all going to jail. You know. And as George is still, you know, following Mary towards the kitchen, so Pete comes up and goes, "Daddy, the Browns next door have a new car. You should see it." And, you know, George is already quite annoyed. And he
Yes.
goes, "Well, what's the matter with our car? Isn't it good enough for you?" "Yes, Daddy." And as Pete says, as he like skulks away, you know,
Yes.
he's been scolded and therefore wants to, you know, get out of the line of fire, I guess you can say. And, you know, his "Yes, Daddy" also says something about that, the way that he says it. And then Tommy continues with his, "Excuse me, excuse me." George looks at him and goes, "Excuse you for what?" And he goes, "I burped." And Mary sweeps in to save the day and goes, "All right, darling, you're excused. Now go on upstairs and see if little Zuzu wants anything." And then George goes, "Zuzu? What's the matter with Zuzu?" You know, that's where basically this minute ends, with George finally realizing that only three of his kids were around, which I guess in his state of mind, that's probably a good thing that he only saw three of them beforehand. You know, he
Yeah.
might have gotten a little more upset if all four were around to bother him.
I just think that it's so interesting in the scene how it's so domestic. Like the frustrations and the kids running around and the wife like saying, "Okay, come and tell me about your problems." Like how that has been so like it's not dated at all. Like that is a typical family setup. Capra always did these stories about family life and everyday people just so well. And I think more so than any other filmmaker of his generation or any generation, I'd say. But I just always think that how believable Jimmy Stewart is as the father and patriarch of this family, even though in real life at this point he wasn't one. So I just find that
Right.
very, very fascinating how believable he looks, how believable he sounds, and his presence in the room and all of that.
Well, again, his character ages a lot in this movie. You know, his character, you know, when Jimmy Stewart starts playing George, so that's in 1928. So, you know, he's playing this character over a period of 18 years. So he has to let him, you know, grow up and evolve and change over that time. You know, in the beginning, But the one thing you see the entire time throughout his adult life is he's always someone who's very reliable and someone that you can completely count on for anything that you need. One thing that never changes.
Yes, he's that sturdy pillar of his family and community in the town, and that's one thing that is consistent throughout the whole movie. Yes.
Yeah, it's great. It's great the way that they show that. They let us know that this is a guy who everyone can count on, which again is part of the main theme of this movie. of everyone knowing that everyone knowing who George Bailey is, even if George Bailey doesn't always know who he is.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's part of what it comes down to, because it reflects also on all of us. It's basically saying to everyone. I mean, it goes back to what you're saying about Capra, how he was able to create characters that people could relate to. And, here we are 78 years later, or 77 and a half years later, we can still relate to these type of characters and to the situations that they're in.
Yes.
It's very timely, so, or timeless, timely, the way that this whole story is being told. And it's largely due to Jimmy Stewart with what he does here, because he and Donna Reed, you believe that this is a couple that every day he comes home and tells his wife about his day, and he talks with his kids, and he plays with his kids and deals with them. But just happens to be that today is a crappy day for him,
Yes.
and he's reached the edge. That's what it comes down to. So, did you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
Just how, again, believable it is how he starts complaining about like people coming over and everything. I think that's a real part of like any, especially Christmas for some reason. You said you don't celebrate Christmas, but I find that while a big part of Christmas is seeing your family and your loved ones and people that you haven't seen like in months, even if they're like your family, like there is that thing of, oh, I have to go see them. I have, and they're coming over. I'm gonna have to like act a certain way and like be, know my place in the family structure. And it's just like that is very, very relatable. It does give some people a source of anxiety, and not just here, but like even if he wasn't dealing with the money problem, the misplaced money, I think that that's enough to get people on edge in general. Just like, oh God, I have to see this person. So that was just so relatable and something that I, as I get older, I understand more and more, I think.
Okay. I mean, we don't celebrate Christmas because we're Jewish, so
Yes.
we have enough holidays. We have enough that we deal with family. So it's not, you guys have one holiday. We have like six throughout the course of the year where we deal with family. So, it's not as if it's not relatable. It's even, in some ways, it's even more relatable.
Oh, wow.
Completely. Because you have constant, I mean, we have one day a week where we get together with family. So,
Oh,
it's
wow.
a lot of family, and you definitely feel this way also sometimes. Sometimes you want family around, sometimes you don't. And it all depends on what's going on in your life at that time. If you had a hectic week at work, maybe at this point you don't want to be with family. Maybe you just want the quiet time and that type of thing. Every Tuesday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track, Uplifting Story Edition, where my guest will give some sort of story, anecdote, adventure, misadventure, something that's happened to them over the course of their life that somehow was uplifting for them or for someone they know or something like that. So, Emily, you have a story for us?
Yes, well, it turns out my entire life could be based on an uplifting premise because I'm adopted from China. I don't know how many people know about the social context, but in the late in the mid in the 90s, there was this big so-called population problem where the country thought that they were growing at too fast of a rate, and they really hunkered down on the one-child policy. And even though it had been in place since the 70s, they had been able to like evade it. No one really paid attention to it. But in the 90s, for some reason, they really started to strictly enforce. So for whatever reason that is going to be unknown for me to me for the rest of my life, I was given up and put into an orphanage, which if you make it to the orphanage, you're actually considered a very lucky child because, you know, infant mortality rates and all that. But and you can't, like a parent who puts up their child for adoption, they're not allowed to take the child straight to the orphanage because that's illegal. Someone else has to, like, say, I found this child at the fire station, I'm taking them to the orphanage, and you can't be the parent. Being adopted and making it out of communist China, that is a pretty uplifting story that whenever I start to think, oh my God, my life sucks, blah, 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 I try to think about that, and I'm like, wait a minute, I'm alive in the first place. I survived in not only being abandoned, but I made it to the orphanage, and then I made it out of the orphanage. So I always try to think about that as the base of my life. It's an uplifting story.
Wow. Okay. Did you ever try to find your real parents?
No, because it's very impossible. Now, here's the thing. Everything about that the Chinese government would give you is from the Chinese government. Like, they claim we can find, like, for my province only. So, like, my sister does not have this option because she's from a different province. And, like, maybe around 2013, they said, oh, there's this internet database, put in your data and we'll eventually find your biological family. But I don't know if that's legit. We have to keep in mind, this is the communist government giving you this information. So I don't know how legit right. that is. I don't, like, nobody that I know who was adopted in the same little group as me, none of them have done it. I'm not going to do it. But I don't, but my reasons are different than maybe theirs are. Mine is, how legit is this? The government is not something that we can really trust. Other than that, I've never been really interested in trying to find them, no. But that's my personal reasoning. Like, but
it's, yeah, okay. Yeah.
I've never put anyone down for wanting to try to find it. Like, I've known some girls who were adopted in my sister's group. They went back to China with them with their families, not to find their biological parents, but to just reconnect with where they're from. I've never really felt the need to do that, because I feel very immersed in the Chinese culture. There's just certain things that I have really taken from the culture that I personally think is really cool. There's elements of my life that I love pasta, not because I'm Chinese, but I always joke, oh, that's really just in my DNA. But just like I'm really big on Chinese New Year, the Lunar New Year. So I feel very immersed in my culture and connected to it without having to like go back there. But
oh wow, that's really cool.
Yeah,
that's really cool. Wait, you have a sister who's also yes, adopted?
She was adopted 2 years after I was. Yes.
Okay, so that's actually a good sign. That means your parents were happy with you, and they said, okay, we're gonna adopt another one.
Yeah,
it's like it wasn't. They didn't get annoyed at you like George Bailey gets annoyed at his kids right now.
Well, for the most part, they're not annoyed with me. But yes, I can definitely say that I've annoyed them sometimes. But they annoy me. So,
sometimes. Well, that's the relationship between parents and kids anyway. Anywhere you look at it, so that makes sense.
Yeah.
All right, great. Thank you very much for that story. So, Emily, you want to once again tell people where they can find you?
Okay, so I am at my film blog, theflapperdamefilm.wordpress.com, and also on YouTube under my name, Emily Graziano. And then I'm on Twitter and Instagram at flapperdame16.
All right, and while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcast you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. You can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on Facebook. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.